World with Dr. Keith Suter.
The Israel-Hamas conflict has entered its fifth week, and fears are growing of a broader war in the Middle East. Tensions continue to rise in the region. Been looking forward to this conversation. First day back, Dr. Keith Suter from Global Directions. He joins me this afternoon. Hello, Keith.
Yes, good afternoon, Brent. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. Keith, look, this Palestinian-Israel crisis, it's not going away. If anything, it's getting worse, and it's looking like it could escalate. I see that over the weekend there were articles in different papers talking about Iran, and I suppose I came away from reading those articles with this opinion that Iran have always been in the background, but this time around it seems as though they're the puppeteers. I mean, they're pulling the strings and supporting Hamas. Would you say that that's a fair and reasonable thing to say?
Yes, although we're not sure to what extent the attack that was done on Israel 3 weeks ago was actually sort of authorized by Iran. They're not natural allies. Hamas is a Sunni movement, and of course, Iran is the leader of the Shia movement, and Iran's major terrorist group in that area is actually Hezbollah, which is at the northern part of Israel on the border with Lebanon. And they are not coming in, you know, full boots and all in support of Hamas. So in their recent statement, the Hezbollah leader made a comment about this being a struggle of the Palestinians. So it's a very delicate balancing act that's going on. Iran has to be careful that it doesn't provoke a full-scale attack by Israel or the United States on Iran. So it needs to support Hamas, but not too explicitly to do so. So I'm still not sure that we will end up with an even wider war than we've currently got at the moment.
Let me compute that. You're still not sure that we won't end up with an even wider war than we've got at the moment. Are you suggesting that this may not escalate more?
It might escalate. It certainly will escalate in some of the Arab countries rather than Iran. The Arab countries, what's called the Arab Street, because they have no democracy, they have no parliament to talk about. But in Arab countries, you have these very volatile crowds, and they are the ones who are pressing their governments to be doing more. So you've got that in Jordan and Syria, Iraq. And so they may well be forced by public pressure within their own countries to sort of join in. So that will certainly be an area of potential expansion, which must be a real worry for the Israelis. Because from the point of view of the Arab governments, they need to be seen to be doing something to support the Palestinians.
I heard someone say the other day, Keith, and I'd like your opinion on this. It was something like this. If Israel lay down their guns, there will be peace. If Palestine lay down their guns, there will be war. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I'm not sure about why Palestine laying down the guns would guarantee more. I wouldn't have thought that if Israel lays down its guns, how therefore is expected to defend itself? Don't forget, Hamas has said that it does not approve of the existence of the state of Israel. So it will continue to fight on. And it's an ideology, by the way, which is why I'm very dubious about the value of the Israeli invasion of Gaza. You can't eradicate an ideology by just simply the use of guns, unless you're going to shoot everybody, and the Israelis won't be able to get away with murdering 2 million people. So from an Israeli point of view, if they lay down the guns, that'll then give scope for Hamas just to remove Israel from the map. So I just don't see how Israel going down a path of peace is going to solve the Israeli issue. That's why I remain very pessimistic about the future of the Middle East, or at least this part of it, because you've got too many people making too many claims on too little land. And so this is going to be a real problem for trying to find any sort of peace at all. And, of course, that's been the difficulty for the U.S. Secretary of State as he's been flying around the Middle East trying to find a way of bringing peace, because clearly the Israelis are not going to reduce their offensive in Gaza, and the people who are in Gaza are continuing to fight, and they actually draw in other Arab leaders to come in on their side.
talking of laying down guns, I suppose this comes with, there's been lots of talk in recent days about a ceasefire. I suppose there's been talk of a ceasefire in recent weeks. Can you see, is it your opinion, that there are possibilities here that a ceasefire could happen? Or, let's take it further, is the only way that this conflict will stop, will it only be by ceasefire?
Well, obviously there has to be a ceasefire at some point. The Israeli argument is that if they were to have a ceasefire now, it would mean that Hamas had won. So the Israelis are going to continue to press on into Gaza. I think they're being sucked into a swamp. You know, they were glad to get out of that area 20-odd years ago, and now they're being drawn back in. How far will they be able to go to, as they say, eradicate Hamas? How do you even know somebody is in Hamas? And, of course, every person they kill in Gaza means they're planting the seeds for the next of kin to get ready to fight Israel in the next round of conflict.
What role, if any, does the United Nations play in this? Because Iran is a member, are they not, of the United Nations? I was reading last week, I thought that somewhere, that one of the members... So am I right in saying Iran is a member of the United Nations?
Of course. Yes. Absolutely. They all are.
And last week, one of the top dogs that is a member of the United Nations, I mean, was given the role of chairman of some committee which is in charge of, I mean, looking after human rights, for goodness sake. And this is in the same week that a 16-year-old girl is killed, beaten to death because she didn't wear a headscarf.
Yeah. I'm not sure if you're referring to the Human Rights Council. I haven't checked to see if it's chairing that. But you're right, there are certain ironies there. But then if you were to go on the basis of some countries being so holier than thou, they are the only ones who would be on the Human Rights Council, whom would you put on? Could you include Australia, for example? That's your problem.
Yeah, I see that Australia continues to what last year was at $95 million, I think we gave to the cause of the United Nations last year in Australia. So do you see this being an extended crisis?
Yeah, and the Israeli Prime Minister has himself said as much. That'll go on for weeks, if not months.
Speaking of the Israeli Prime Minister, there's been lots of articles written about, you know, this is doing him damage and, you know, he could be asked to step down. Do you see that happening?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, his career is finished. Now, whether it'll be done during the conflict or immediately afterwards, that's going to be the question. But no, he's now finished. I can't imagine he's going to survive this crisis. He's a great survivalist in Israeli politics, but I don't think he's going to be able to survive this one.
I suppose Ukraine and Russia. What role does Russia play here?
In the
Palestine Israeli crisis. I mean, Russia's not saying much at the moment, are they?
No, whereas they're keeping quiet because Israel has not been as condemnatory of the Russian invasion of Ukraine as, say, Australia has been. So the Israeli government is playing a very fine line because you've obviously got a number of Russian Jews now who have fled to live in Israel. So there are Russians very much present in Israel. And at the same time, that there are still close connections between Israel and Russia. And so the Israeli government has not been as critical of the Russian invasion of Ukraine as Australia or the British or the Americans have been. So that's another very fine balancing act which they've got underway.
The Palestine-Israeli crisis, of course, has taken the Ukraine and Russian crisis off the front pages. It used to be there daily on the front pages of the press and, you know, lead stories in news bulletins on TV and radio, but that is not the case anymore.
No, and Putin's very happy about that, I can tell you. So he's no longer getting the sort of mass coverage that he was receiving before. And it's also causing confusion back in the United States, where the US has been the major ally of Ukraine. But now, of course, its resources are being divided because they also need to go to Israel as well. And this has meant that some members of the Republican Party have been able to say, well, let's leave Ukraine alone. Let's now concentrate on trying to help Israel. So this will be a further damage to Ukraine's prospects of ever beating the Russians.
You've been covering foreign stories for many, many years now, Keith. Could I ask you this? Have you seen a worse time when the world is at unrest, unsettled, than what we are currently?
I think you always have a tendency to think the worst because the news is so immediately upon us. I think that we've had bad times in the past, particularly the Vietnam War, etc. And, of course, you know, living through the Cold War and the risk of nuclear annihilation. And it's interesting how America and Russia are now moving away from all those treaties that were negotiated, for example, at the time of President Reagan and Premier Gorbachev. So, you know, we had a very bad time in the 70s and 80s with a nuclear arms race, with the Russian invasion, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the Americans bogged down in Vietnam and elsewhere. So I've lived through a few crises, which means that I'm perhaps got a little more sang-froid when it comes to these issues than some of my younger colleagues who seem to think that, you know, we're living in a uniquely bad time. I think that we've gone through worse times and we have managed to survive them. Now, of course, we've got the climate change threat, which is the new development, and that causes all sorts of complications for all of our calculations, including, you know, for example, China. We're very worried about China, but don't forget a lot of their own defense forces are tied up dealing with floods and bushfires. So although China's got a huge standing army, they have to deploy some of that army actually trying to protect the environment in China. So it's a much more complicated world. I certainly think that's the point of view, that it's much more complicated now than we would have had back in the Cold War. We look back on the Cold War with nostalgia. Everything seems so much more black and white in those days than it compares with today.
The other situation that we face daily these days is, as it happens, it's on your TV screen or it's reported on your radio or you read about it in the press. It's a 24/7 news cycle. And, you know, we, I suppose there's a generation of people that have known nothing less than a 24/7 news cycle. But for oldies like you and I, it's all new to us, isn't it?
It is. But I think we're better able to cope with it because we've lived through so many previous crises. And that's what I try to emphasize to my young students who at the age of 20 are very anxious about the future of the world. It's not an argument about being complacent, but it does mean that we have survived in the past and as a human race many other tragedies, and we've managed to come through all right.
Well said. It's always good to talk to you. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me this afternoon, Keith.
Thank you.
Dr. Keith Suter from Global Directions.